This reading is from Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought or grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Thanks for being here this morning. I wanted to share some ideas with you about something that in the current vernacular is called nature mysticism. There have been many other words for it over the ages, but that's basically what we're calling it nowadays. And I referenced my older sister when I was giving you the story for the all ages, and she is what most people would call a pagan. She believes, as I do, that nature is alive and far more intelligent than we are, and it's a tangible manifestation of the spiritual power that underlies the universe. Yet, she is regarded askance by many folks who harbor more traditional religious beliefs, which I entirely respect. This is nothing new, as we shall see. My sister, Florence, has always wondered out loud as to why people are so eager to worship what they can't see, when all about them is God incarnate, the sun, the life force, the miracle of birth, the improbable mystery of existence itself. And to her, the biblical phrase, quote, "and the word was made flesh," unquote, is a statement that suggests that the Creator resides within the creation, that the Great Spirit is incarnate in nature, enervating it with life and verve. She is, as I said, a Wiccan, or what some might call a witch. She's also what I call a nature mystic, someone who seeks to blend her consciousness and sense of self with the divine power that is incarnate in the natural world, certainly from her belief system. And just what exactly is a nature mystic? A person who, when in the presence of the natural world, has a full soul. Someone who has been spiritually sculpted by interactions with nature in ways that are enlightening, enlivening, not to mention just plain wondrous. These are people who are bonded with the creation so intensely that no matter what else befalls them in life, nature will always provide a sanctuary and a place of worship. Therein, they are as close as they can be to whatever they consider their God. Despite my lifelong affinity for what most simply call the great outdoors, it took me a few decades to realize that this attraction was not simply about good feelings, sensory delights, and some wild adventures. For me, it has been and remains a deeply spiritual path, and one that has constituted my primary faith journey. The day this full realization came to me, I called a dear friend of mine who shares the same bond that I have with the natural realm. His name is Mike, and I said, "Mike, I just realized that you're a nature mystic." There was a brief pause on the other end of the line, and then he replied, "Is there any other kind? What does nature have to do with a mystical state of being? Well, first of all, it is our primal home. As philosopher Alan Watts reminded us, quote, we don't come into the world, we come out of it. And to it we all return. Deep in our synapses and within the infinitesimally tiny structures of each cell and atom in our bodies, nature is bedrock. It is the whatever it is that we call the life force, an invisible energy that permeates the entire cosmos from massive galaxy to Homo sapiens to a minuscule quark, comprising an incredibly complex system that in aggregate functions like an intelligent organism in its own right. Over endless eons of time that stretch beyond our mental horizons and then simply disappear, this force has continually created, destroyed, recreated, and transformed all the structures and processes that constitute our universe. It's a powerful thing, the most powerful one we know. And when we go mind open and with soul into the natural world, it is this power that we encounter and in which we dwell. It is there, while in the presence of this most elemental and vital of all forces, that we can recognize what is unshakably true in ourselves and in this strange trip called existence. There is the social you, there is the self-reflecting you, there is the private you, and then at the core, There is the essential you, the one that remembers in a diffuse and largely unconscious way what it was like to be outside of time, unfettered by space, and immersed in a unity beyond all things. Some call it the oceanic feeling. Others name it cosmic consciousness or simply the all. No matter the labels, nature can open a door to one's innermost self, to the immutable core of your consciousness that is unencumbered by the world of people, deadlines, egos, and tasks. This is a truth that Homo sapiens realized for millennia, long before recorded history. Since the ancients first deified the sun as the primary source of life, which on our planet is quite literally true, we humans have understood that there is a power and purpose to the natural world that is far greater than any technology or intelligence in our possession. Genuine power is not in skyscrapers or missiles or machines. It is in hurricanes, earthquakes, volcanoes, floods, supernovas, quasars, black holes. It is in the birthing of stars, the tenacity of the life force, the verdant fields in spring, galaxies, comets, newborns. And while modern folk have largely lost dialogue with this power, it waits for us to open its doors and learn its ways. And it is within the ways of nature that we can discover a clearer sense of who we are, why we are, and to what we belong. The roots of nature mysticism are indeed ancient, and they are largely found in the practices and beliefs of so-called pagans. As best we can figure out, the earliest pagan religions began sometime before 10,000 BCE, probably during the Paleolithic Age. At that time, most humans lived in tribal communities that were nomadic hunter-gatherers, and they were deeply embedded in the rhythms and workings of the natural world. Their gods were the mysterious forces that shaped their lives: the sun, the moon, other celestial bodies, the seasons, animals and plants that afforded them food and clothing and shelter and herbal medicine, and the atmospheric and tectonic forces that reigned over their world. It was during this time that the concept of the goddess emerged. Women were recognized as the bearers of new life, and associations were made between their own fertility and that of the life force working through plants and animals and seasonal fluctuations. Deities took on gender characteristics. The sun was often viewed as masculine, while the moon assumed a feminine motif. But in contrast to the male domination so prevalent in many of the Abrahamic religions, a strongly patriarchal lineage, paganism embraced both aspects, male and female, and often deferred to the goddess or earth mother as the primary deity. Given such humble, harmless, and natural beginnings, how did paganism come to be viewed with so much skepticism, fear, and in some cases outright hatred? For the majority of Americans, the term pagan continues to have a negative connotation, one associated with demonic forces and superstition, black magic, and craven rituals, essentially what Star Wars groupies would call the dark side. This bias represents the lingering presence of a very destructive and dark period in human history, but its darkness did not emanate from pagans. The term pagan is from the Latin word paganus, which means rural or of the country. It did not become a derogatory term until the Roman Empire, under the rule of Emperor Constantine, adopted Christianity as its state religion in the 4th century of the modern era, at which point those persons and tribes practicing polytheism, or the worship of many gods, including nature deities, were pressured and later persecuted to convert or else. By the end of the 4th century, polytheistic religious practices, which were widespread in rural Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, went underground to avoid being terrorized by the Roman Empire, hell-bent as it was on forcing its faith upon all its subjects. Given that the Abrahamic religions, which are Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, harbored a bias against the belief that nature is a manifestation of divine power, and in favor of the idea that God is a transcendent deity far removed from the creation itself, pagans were quickly branded as evil. What followed were centuries of persecution in various guises, from the burning of witches to the genocide perpetrated against many indigenous peoples, including Native Americans. Most notable of these sad episodes was the burning time, when witches, or Wiccans, were tortured and murdered on a large scale over several centuries, up to 9 million of them. The infamous Salem witch trials occurred toward the conclusion of this sad epic. The last known person to be murdered for practicing so-called witchcraft was in Australia in 1747. But it wasn't until 1951 that the last law prohibiting and punishing witchcraft was abolished. That was in Great Britain. All of this mayhem was perpetrated in the name of God. It wasn't until 1985 that Wicca, the most prevalent of the pagan belief systems in the West, was officially recognized as a religion in its own right. Today, interestingly enough, census surveys indicate that about 250,000 people practice Wicca in North America, although this number is believed to be low because many are still reluctant to openly acknowledge this spiritual affiliation. The dark wake from the Great Persecution and the Burning Time still lingers. In terms of the number of adherents in the United States, I looked this up last night just to be sure, Wicca ranks right behind Unitarian Universalism. By the way, when I got up this morning and was getting ready to come over here and had gotten dressed and was standing in the kitchen, my wife said, "Now, who are you talking to this morning?" And I said, "I'm talking to a Unitarian congregation." And she said, "You're overdressed." Anyway, I digress. In contrast to so-called Western civilization, Eastern religious traditions have been more comfortable with pagan ideas. Hinduism has a strong polytheistic lineage. Taoism, which was birthed in China, is deeply nature-based. And in general, those who ascribe to Eastern religions have not embraced the bias that associates nature and the earth with evil and the immaterial or invisible with the divine. What all nature-based spiritual traditions embrace is a direct experience with the divine through the conduit of the natural world. Today, the modus operandi of the nature mystic involves two primary ceremonies or rituals, if you will. The first I call soulfulness, which is basically any sensory-based experience that alters one's consciousness by diluting the ego and amplifying a sense of oneness with nature itself. We'll get into some examples of that in a moment. The other is something I call blending, which involves closely aligning with an aspect or a process in nature, not only through one's consciousness, which is what soulfulness is about, but also one's physiology. I often describe soulfulness as extroverted meditation. It involves escaping the boundaries of the ego, which likes to exist in its own little bubble of self-absorption and presumed significance, in order to experientially join one's psyche and spirit with natural environment and its manifestations. Soulfulness draws us closer to the sacred consciousness that Wiccan believe is incarnate in space, time, matter, and energy. Through it, one discovers that everything in process in nature is imbued with this mysterious power we call the life force. So when in a soulful state, we experience all phenomena as alive and sentient. Even the rocks, like the one I was holding in my hand during the story. Interestingly enough, in the Native American tradition, there's a saying that goes, a rock breathes once every 1,000 years. The Native Americans also say that the rocks hold the memory of the earth, which a geologist will tell you is quite literally true. And to a nature mystic, a rock is just as alive as anything else in the natural world. Now, blending, in contrast, invokes the consciousness associated with the body, not just the brain, as soulfulness tends to do. Nature mystics align their physiology and movements to create a shared space with something in the natural world. Could be anything. Prairie grass blowing in the wind, waves crashing on the shore, wind blowing, we've had a lot of that lately, clouds, trees, rain, you name it. Through ceremonies and rituals, whether collective or individual, the nature mystic seeks to blend his or her body, energy, and presence with entities and processes in nature. This is the basis for, by the way, full-body immersion baptism in Christianity, one of many traditional religious practices derived from so-called pagan rituals. Now, there is some anthropological research suggesting that the most frequent catalyst for mystical experiences, even among those in more traditional religious traditions, including Christianity, is nature. Put another way, nature is a doorway to the mystical communion with the divine, and one that can just as readily occur spontaneously as through conscious effort. We're all familiar with the stories of Jesus going into the desert for his epiphany, of Buddha meditating under the Bodhi tree, and the other tales of prophets and sages and in the wilderness. Most of us have, by happenstance, walked through or at least look through some of the mystical portals afforded by the natural world. If you've ever been genuinely smitten by a radiant sunset, a rainbow set against a stormy sky, the hiss of snow falling in a dark woods at night, or the melodic singing of birds, then a door has been opened to you, even if just a crack, affording you an experience of this thing called soulfulness. Most of us assume that, as such, these doors simply lead to an encounter with nature's beauty, and we leave it at that. But there's more within, much more, as many have reminded us. Meister Eckhart, one of Christianity's greatest mystics, wrote of moments when, quote, all blades of grass, wood, and stone, all things are one. In his meditations involving nature, he entered a sublime awareness that enveloped his ego as the air does your breath on a cold morning. As he wrote, quote, apprehend God in all things, for God is in all things. Every single creature is full of God and is a book about God. Every creature is a word of God. Noted anthropologist Joseph Campbell said that God is the experience of looking at a tree and saying, ah. He recognized that any manifestation of nature that has the potential to connect with our consciousness and trigger recognition of the spiritual oneness of the creation. I'm reminded also of a teaching tale from the Zen Buddhist master Gensha. Gensha was sitting with one of his monks in training, and the monk said to him, where can I enter Zen? And Gensha replied, can you hear the babbling brook? Monk said, yes, I can hear it. And Gensha replied, then enter there. From the Native American tradition, there are the words, a brave buffalo, a Lakota shaman, who said, when I was 10 years of age, I looked at the land and the rivers, the sky above and the animals around me, and could not fail to realize that they were made by some great power. I was so anxious to understand this power that I questioned the trees and the bushes. It seemed as though the flowers were staring at me, and I wanted to ask them, who made you? How many times have you paused to listen in the broadest possible sense to the babbling of the brook, the birds in their melodic singing, the shush of a waterfall, or the timeless music of crickets on a warm summer evening? Perhaps in those moments, nature momentarily held you as it whispered to your soul through the flesh of the creation. Maybe even if briefly time slowed, your thoughts went mute, you forgot yourself and your life, and there was only that ethereal whisper through that opened door of nature. For those who wish to enter into the mystery of the creation, who long for relationship with the divine, and who want to leave the prison cell of the ego and take spiritual flight, nature provides ways. These are not the paths of some human-made religion or pedantic ritual, but rather the uncentered expression of the Creator in material form. Soulfulness and blending, then, are states of being and doing that create and sustain a mystical engagement with nature. So let's consider what these approaches require. Our day-to-day consciousness is often based on the perception and belief that creation is a multiplicity of individual things. Human consciousness, in particular, experiences itself as a separate entity. In our case, an individual brain with a distinct sense of me moving around with the aid of a body. Put another way, most of us experience ourselves somewhat like raindrops, which are distinct caplets of water suspended in the atmosphere and separated from everything else by a border, in our case, our skin. In contrast, during periods of soulfulness, the nature mystic experiences her or himself as immersed in a sea, as part of a continuous, flowing essence that has no clear boundary, no beginning, no end. While everyday rational consciousness is granular and fragmented and sort of object-oriented, mystical awareness is cohesive and boundless and ethereal. So when one's consciousness escapes the illusion of being separate from the rest of nature and embraces this holistic reality through direct experience or soulfulness, rather than simply through thought, then there's occurrence of what Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu called primal union, a sense of oneness with the all. Soulfulness is a nature mystic's path to this primal union, and learning it is entirely experiential. You have to do it, not just think it. And the first step is usually through one's senses, simply going into the natural world, seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling. As the renegade psychoanalyst Fritz Perls admonished us, quote, lose your mind and come to your senses. very apt advice for a would-be nature mystic. What the nature mystic senses in the creation is quite simply the sacred. Everywhere that she or he looks, the Creator looks back. Each time that a nature mystic brings his or her eye into contact with the natural realm, she or he experiences a thou, a living entity, not an it or a thing. So soulfulness is essentially a manner of perceiving, of seeing the beatific in what most regard as the ordinary or simply the pleasing or beautiful. Like the aesthetically sensitive person who can absorb the mesmerizing nuances of a song, painting, or sculpture, the nature mystic sees far more than most. To her or him, there is no such thing as just clouds or a mere toad or an ordinary tree. The seeds of soulfulness are most often planted during childhood, before we are taught to regard nature as a thing, a material machine, rather than a living, numinous manifestation of the divine. And my first memory in this regard remains vivid in my mind. Perhaps yours does as well. I'll tell you about that. I had pushed and pulled my radio flyer wagon to the edge of a large, viscous mud puddle where home plate in our makeshift ballpark had once been. That was before the big rains had come. After they stopped, our little ball yard in the vacant lot adjacent to my house was a wetland in its own right, at least temporarily. The deluge had dissipated a short time before, but a light mist still wafted through the air. All around us was the dripping and running of water, and it called to me. I had to be part of it. A tyke just 4:30, and youngest of the family's 5 progeny, I was often left to my own devices, which in this case was about to demonstrate why that wasn't always a prudent approach to child rearing. Scrambling into the bed of my little wagon, I stopped to take a furtive sweep of the area to see if any adults or power-mad children were about. Seeing none, I turned to my objective, the muck. I couldn't see it, of course, but I felt a mischievous smile take hold of my face. Opening my raised arms like wings, I closed my eyes, screamed with glee, and leapt forth into the annals of charred family lore. Shortly thereafter, at the conclusion of repeated vaults into the mud puddle, punctuated by squeals of delight, I appeared at the back door of our house, where I was greeted, if that's the right word, by my mother. I was covered head to toe in muddy water and muck. As one would expect, she was aghast. And once she regained her capacity to speak, admonitions flowed freely from her mouth. But there was something else I saw in her expression. It became a bit more evident when she had me standing up in the wash tub in the basement while hosing me down. There was a twinkle in those Irish eyes. In retrospect, that shouldn't have surprised me. Mom was forever outdoors, gardening, hanging the wash, sitting by the lake, shucking corn, and relaxing on the porch swing. She always told us that if we were feeling blue, we should get some dirt under our fingernails, and then we'd feel right as rain. She was salt of the earth. In some fashion that she probably couldn't have articulated, Mom completely understood why her 4-year-old baby of the family would want to soak himself through and through with muddy water and just plain dirt. She recognized, as something did in my own spirit, that I was simply trying to get closer to my other mother, Earth. It should have been clear then that I was not going to be someone who mostly peered out at the natural world through a car window or on a screensaver. My association with soulfulness was coming into its own, partly in that mud puddle, and partly under the spontaneous pull of something I had yet to quite understand. For that and for what has since followed in my relationship with the creation, I am most grateful. So I invite you to venture down your own memory lane in this regard. What are some of your first recollections of the natural world? Were they tinged with quiet and wonder? Did you burst forth with delight and awe? Or were there moments of recoil and fear or pain? Do you remember what it was like to be in that state of childlike fascination, the kind that comes intuitively from the part of you that still knows where its existential home resides? How did you first behold one of creation's doors, and did you ever walk any of its ways, its paths into the mystery? Virtually every person I have spoken with has done just that. It is a near universal experience, and that gives me real hope. It is through the eyes of a child that the nature mystic seeks to see. It is with those sensitive neophyte fingers that she or he tries to touch the natural world. It is those fresh and wide open ears that become the portal for listening to the sounds of the creation. It is the acute sensory perceptions, innocent wonder, and oceanic consciousness of the child that best describe the state of being that a nature mystic embraces. In those moments when the Creator opens a door to our souls and beckons through the natural world, we decide whether to enter. I bid you to choose wisely, and I ask that you considering embracing nature's ways. I'd like to close with a quote from Rachel Carson. Many of you know she wrote Silent Spring. And then another quote from Walt Whitman. From Rachel Carson, those who dwell among the beauties and mysteries of earth are never alone or weary of life. And from Walt Whitman, when all else leaves us in this world, wealth, fame, beauty, people, nature remains. Thank you.